Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly performing arts magazine. I'm your host, David Latulipe. This week, we'll have previews of the San Francisco Wind Ensemble's final concert of the season, as well as the UC Alumni Chorus's production of Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, which is being produced in collaboration with Smuin Ballet. Also, actor-playwright Jeff Hoyle shares details about his latest solo show, Lear's Shadow, which explores one of Shakespeare's most powerful plays through a new lens, that of the King Lear's recently unemployed jester. Plus, Peter Robinson will be by to offer a movie review, Woman in Gold, and takes us to an exhibit at the Legion of Honor here in San Francisco. Stay with us. Just a taste of part of David Maslanka's Symphony No. 7, which you'll hear the San Francisco Wind Ensemble perform as part of their concert Saturday evening in San Mateo. Now, I've had the pleasure to speak with the ensemble's director, Martin Segalka, who was recently appointed director of bands at the University of Illinois. As we speak, he's en route to the West Coast, flying off for this performance on Saturday. Here to talk about the concert is one of the percussionists, which, as you can hear, is very busy in that piece, Ryan Blauvelt, who's originally from Southern California, and in addition to performing in a number of Bay Area ensembles as a percussionist, he is digital print publishing manager for Sheet Music Plus in Emeryville, California. Freelance musician, busy boy, and very busy in this piece. My goodness. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So that piece is, what kind of a battery of percussion is involved in just the Maslanka?
We've got six players. We've got two marimbas, two vibes, two xylos. It's a huge, huge setup. And we just had a sectional last weekend in the East Bay. And we all, like, now that we're getting into this disband and we're having so much fun, the music is getting harder and we're getting a better chemistry, but we need a sectional every single weekend. So we got together last weekend and hashed it all out really, really slow because, as you can hear, it's really fast. So
a lot going on.
Yeah, a lot going on.
What are the other works on the program, and are they as percussive intense?
The Maslanka is definitely the most intense out of the three. The other two, Prokofiev Athletic Festival March and Stephen Stuckey's Thranos, are not as involved as the Maslanka. That's typically lately what we've been doing is having a large dazzler kind of a piece, and having some of the two that are equally as strong in terms of strength of repertoire, but the Maslanka in this case is definitely like the highlight.
You've been with the percussion section of the San Francisco Wind Ensemble since 2012 and was recently appointed to the board. You've seen quite a ride already with this extraordinary ensemble, accolades left and right. One of the only professional-level wind ensembles in this entire area of the country.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we established the board, and we've been getting very, very organized and doing some really great stuff. We recorded at Skywalker Ranch last year, and over 3 days, it was just absolute bucket list thing for all of us, and we were invited to perform at the California All-State Music Education Conference in Fresno last year.
Well, let's back up for a moment to the recording at the Skywalker Ranch. What was that like?
It was amazing, absolutely amazing. I mean, just an experience of having microphones everywhere and sound technicians coming up and adjusting, you know, exactly where we were going to be playing, exactly how we were attacking each instrument, and making sure that they were capturing like the essence of what we were doing and the best angle of what we could produce sound-wise.
Not too bad having Grammy Award-winning producer and engineer Leslie Ann Jones at the helm
of
that.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what's going to be on that CD?
You know, I...
A taste. What do you remember recording?
I mean, that's a great question. I don't exactly recall the repertoire. It was recorded over 3 days, and... you know, like, I will definitely let you know. It was, like, about a year ago, and the repertoire was selected by Martin, and it was designed to really kind of represent, you know, what SFWE really represents, which is incredible cutting-edge wind band repertoire with, you know, with a band...
With very few rehearsals.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing.
We're a shotgun band.
Yeah,
we're a shotgun format. We rehearse... Friday night, Saturday day, and then Saturday night as our concert.
Almost like a flash mob experience.
Absolutely, yeah.
But and, with people that have seen the music and been studying.
Yeah, and it's really hard music, so it's kind of baffling to everybody, to us, that we're able to get together and really make it happen. And nowadays, like, a sectional is absolutely necessary. But all the section leaders get their music ahead of time, and we prepare, and we're all professionals. And so we come together, and we just... have an awesome concert, and we put on a great show.
The CD is going to be released next year. It was the subject of an Indiegogo campaign to get it funded. How much funded is it at this point?
It is about 85% funded, but we have, I think, locked in a little bit additional support to put us over the edge. But you can always donate on our website. There is a tab at the very top of the site, sfwindensemble.org. And it says donate up top there. So you can definitely help support the San Francisco Wind Ensemble, create its first CD. It's a big deal for us. And again, that represents our experience at Skywalker Ranch. So it's going to be a really great thing. We're really excited about it.
Directions to this Saturday's concert at Aragon High School Theater in San Mateo, also at that website, sfwindensemble.org. The concert's at 7:30 on Saturday.
Yeah.
Let's see. The ensemble was invited to be a featured guest ensemble at the 2014 California Music Educators Association Conference in Fresno. Now, how did that invitation come about?
You know, I am very personally involved with that conference on a sort of side project. I run a lot of the marketing and a lot of the social media for the conference, and a lot of our colleagues are music teachers, and Martin was at the time with SF State and just got invited to come play at CASMEC, and it was a floor. We just raised the roof. We seriously like blew the roof off with that performance, and so that kind of really got us going, got our momentum going, and the WASB invitation came soon after that.
Well, let's talk about that. The World Association of Symphonic Bands and Ensembles, that conference is going to be in San Jose, California, nearby, fortunately, and for a world conference, maybe not as exotic as you were hoping, but quite a prestigious invitation.
Well, you know, WASB is kind of like the Olympics for wind bands. It only happens every 2 years. It rotates around the world. It's the only international organization for wind band conductors and composers and repertoire. And we are the opening act for WASB, which we're really excited about. Sunday, July 12th, 3 p.m. at the California Theater in San Jose. We do have our repertoire established for that, but we're not going to announce that you know, right away. But we do have we're not relying on our usual shotgun format to prepare for that. We're going to have lots and lots of rehearsals to really get ready for that one, because we really want to make a huge impression on the World Association of Symphonic Bands.
Mm-hmm. Nice. You seem to have found a home at Aragon High School, and you're working with its wind ensemble as well. How is that going? How often are the ensemble members interacting?
It's going great. Those kids are really awesome. The Aragon High School kids are great. The percussionists, specifically, all of our equipment is set up for us before the show, which is incredible for us. Like, we're always the first to come, last to leave. And Aragon High School and Troy Davis, conductor, they've been extremely helpful. And it's an incredible theater. It sounds amazing. And we've got great equipment. And, it's been a really positive experience so far.
Nice.
Yeah.
So also on the program is Stephen Stuckey's Threnos. Tell us about that piece.
Threnos is kind of sort of antithetical what Maslanka is. Like, Threnos seems like it's different. There's more space. It sounds, it just has more of a, it's a wind band piece, but the percussion parts specifically feels like a chamber work, and it's a lot more space in it, and there's a lot, there's a lot more dichotomy in it, and it goes from violent to very quiet very, very quickly. Yeah, it's definitely not as like explosive as Maslanka, and I think maybe that's why maybe that motivated Martin to program it into it.
Sure.
It's really great. It's definitely a lot more contemporary sounding, quote unquote, if you will.
Let's have a little listen to just a small portion of the Stephen Stuckey, then great. More with Ryan Blauvelt about the San Francisco Wind Ensemble's performance. Audio taste of music of Stephen Stuckey, Threnos, also being performed on Saturday, 7:30, Aragon High School, as part of the San Francisco Wind Ensemble's performance under the direction of Martin Segelka. Ryan Blauvelt here in the percussion section telling us a little bit about that concert. That's very different than the Maslanka, and it
Absolutely.
Is quite spare and very evocative.
Yeah, definitely very much. And looking forward to hearing the contrast between the Maslanka and the Stuckey. And it's just, the sounds coming out of percussion, for the Stuckey are just a little bit more, it feels jagged, and the whole piece feels like there's a violence to it that's very, very subtle, where the Maslanka is, I feel I might be, totally wrong on this, but I feel like Maslanka has this more of a Mahler, wanting to encompass the universe in his symphonies. And there's a Maslankian approach that, Symphony No. 7 is a good representation of that. But the Stuckey is sort of an antithetical, solution to that one.
Mm-hmm. What's our plans for next season? Are they underway?
They're underway. Yeah. We are, to date, we are still going to be at Aragon High School. We are always looking for new collaborations, and we've got a really organized board, really hardworking people that we have regular board meetings, and we've got, we're very organized, and we're motivated to make the SF Wind Ensemble something that that people are proud of, that that San Francisco can call, you know, it San Francisco Wind Ensemble, like part of its, you know, performing arts scene. So yeah, we're really motivated to just like build this ensemble just into a real powerhouse. And yeah, things are looking great.
You're well on the road to it. Ryan, thanks so much for coming in to talk about the concert on Saturday. We wish you every good luck on this concert as well as planning for the next season as part of the board.
Thank you, David.
Martin Segalka conducts the San Francisco Wind Ensemble Saturday evening at 7:30, Aragon High School, 900 Alameda de las Pulgas in San Mateo. Information at sfwindensemble.org. Still to come here on Open Air, a discussion with Jeff Hoyle about his one-man show at the Marsh. We'll hear about the UC Alumni Chorus's production of Carmina Burana, and Peter Robinson will be by to talk about some movies and some museums. Also on this program on the San Francisco Wind Ensemble is music of Sergei Prokofiev, his Athletic Festival March. Let's hear a little bit of that as we change musical chairs here during Open Air. Music of Sergei Prokofiev being performed as part of the San Francisco Wind Ensemble's concert this Saturday at 7:30. Information at sfwindensemble.org. And coming up, we have some additional music by Carl Orff and Carmina Burana. Well, I last had the pleasure to witness in performance and talk with award-winning actor, funny man Jeff Hoyle during his tour de force production of Geezer at the Marsh, in which he railed against, observed, and generally seemed confounded, surprised, and amused by the indignities and inconveniences heaped upon us as we age, sometimes gracefully, sometimes with a body that doesn't cooperate so much. Well, he's back at the Marsh through the end of May with his latest one-man show, Lear's Shadow, written in collaboration with and directed by David Ford. It tells the story of the Bard's great tragedy, Post-Mortem Rex, from the perspective of the now unemployed fool. It is indeed a pleasure to welcome one of the most highly regarded physical comedy actors back to our airwaves. Jeff, welcome to Open Air once again.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, I should say welcome to Hoyle Pater, as I've also had the pleasure to talk with your son, Dan, who now makes his home in the no doubt now terribly trendy South Bronx. He'll have a solo show at Joe's Pub in New York later this month, and he's back here in San Francisco in June. How's he doing?
He's doing very well. Right now he's on vacation, but he'll be back this summer at the Marsh with Each and Everything, which is his latest, and it's perhaps his best. I think it's wonderful. But then I am the potter, as you say.
giving potterly advice of only when asked, or do you offer it unsolicited advice?
Only when asked now. He calls me his greatest free drama coach that he's ever had. But
cost you quite a penny, though.
Oh, yeah.
Over the years.
Put me through the ringer. But, yeah, I don't offer any unsolicited advice. If he asks me what I think, I give him my 2 cents.
But you'd tell him if it really stunk, too, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but he never does. He's better than me.
Now, this is a good month for revisiting Shakespeare's King Lear. Just last week, I interviewed Conrad Bishop and Elizabeth Fuller, who are doing a two-person, 30-puppet performance of Lear at the Emerald Tablet here in San Francisco. Tell me about your relationship in general with Shakespeare.
Well, I was married to him for 34 years. But no, actually, the 23rd of April is his reputed birthday. Mine is the 15th. of April.
Coming up, yes.
Coming up, tax day. Don't forget to file. And also the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, which is probably quite appropriate for my career. And I've had a relationship as an English schoolboy with Shakespeare since I was probably about 11. I know a bank where the wild thyme grows. Commit that to memory. Tomorrow afternoon, we'll hear everybody's version. Ah! So I've been line phobic ever since. But King Lear was my set book for my A-level
what is that
examinations.
A-level,
they're not really, they're somewhat similar to the SATs, except that they're not multiple choice questions or anything like that. You have to write a series of essays during the time. And so we had to study Lear, and we couldn't take the text in with us. So any quotes we had to commit to memory. So there's a lot of it that I've already known for about 50, 60 years.
Stuck
almost.
In those brainwaves, yeah.
Yeah.
No doubt.
But I'm still, you know, jumpy when I have to actually speak the Shakespeare, because there are people who know it. And also, if you get it wrong, it's never quite as good as what Shakespeare wrote. So I have to work very hard at remembering it.
To be or not to really want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To be
people kind of catch that.
Maybe. Well, no. To what? To, yeah. You can imagine him writing it.
To be, therefore I am. No,
yeah,
wait.
No.
That doesn't work either.
All of those.
Scratch that with your quill.
Yeah. Or throw an ink blot on it. And my relationship with Shakespeare goes way back. And I've never done the fool in Lear. In fact, I've not really played any Shakespeare clowns other than Stefano in The Tempest, who is not really a clown, but he's a character clown.
I was going to say, are you a follower of Shakespeare's fools in general? Character study?
They're really obscure. This is the problem. They don't speak to us in the same way.
Well, especially York.
Not
speaking much at all.
Sure, yeah. Touchstone, you know, well, okay, sort of funny. Autolycus, I think, in The Winter's Tale. Then Jaques in As You Like It. But there are Paroles, I guess, is that another one. And then there's The Fool in Lear, who isn't really that funny and speaks in this medieval, tautological, strange, riddle-strewn language.
And is far from a fool when it comes down to it. He's really giving the king...
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always loved King Lear and I always wanted to play it. And no one will ever cast me as King Lear because I'm 130 pounds and I'm, 5 feet six.
Well, there's padding. There's elevator shoes.
Padding. All right there. That's right. There's padding. I know. We'll go out and have a little drink. And then we'll go to the bath. Yeah, I don't know where that's going. We're going to put it down. How would you like that? That's what it sounds like when you speak to some of these young Irish lads. Well, no, Ed. Oh, no, that doorway, we can comb that down a little bit on there. I'm pretty sure they're on the bottom there, and we're going to get it. And then we'll trace it out to the top there, and then we'll pull them right out. And when you pull that back, and it'll be all right and ready to go out. Would you like that? It'll only be a little tissue. It'll only be a little bit of that. I'm tired of you. And about $250.
And then you need super titles to hear them
and
on stage.
And you just usually say, sure, yeah, you should. Yeah, do that. Yeah.
Ka-ching.
Yeah, it's good.
So in productions of Lear that you've seen, we were always more interested in maybe watching the acting skills and role interpretation of the fool than Lear?
Was I always interested? I'm probably more interested in Lear in a sense. And the fool is his prop and his, his cufflink and his first thing handy at the side of the stage to hit. And then the fool disappears in the middle of the show, because Edgar comes along and obviously Shakespeare thinks, well, I don't need two fools or two bottom-of-the-barrel scrapers, so we'll get rid of the fool. So he just disappears, literally just goes. So what we thought was, well, maybe the fool is there, even though he doesn't have any words. And then as a friend of mine who's a writer, I was in Paris, and we were sitting in a cafe, and I was telling him about this idea for doing something on Lear, because I wanted to do some of Lear. And he said, well, and everybody says, oh, yeah, Jeff Wellman cast him as the fool. Thanks a lot. And he said, well, why don't you tell the story of Lear from the point of view of the fool? And so that's what David Ford and I set out to do. And we took great liberties. We deconstructed it. There are a lot of purists who will probably be very unhappy with what we did, which is great. Because, you know, that's what we
do. Pushes the envelope a little
bit.
Yeah.
It's perfect
for the marsh as well.
Yeah, tear it down. Do something new with it. Look at it from a different point of view. And you'll never watch King Lear the same way again.
So was I right in the introduction in that this is post-mortem Rex, and then this is after the king dies and he is now...
Post-mortem
the
Rex. Yes, after the death of the king's dog, Rex. Yeah, no, it is. It takes the form. I don't want to say too much because I think people will be surprised at how we do it a little bit. But yes, the fool comes back after the play is over, and after the events of the play are over, and then he is, in a certain way, shunted into the position of having to tell the story of it, and he does. And I, as an actor, play the fool and Lear and the three daughters, Regan, Goneril, and Cordelia.
Okay.
There's no Gloucester. We got rid of that. And there's one person who came to an early preview.
And it's set in Japan. No.
Yeah, no. I don't do that Robert Wilson stuff. King Lear. He calls him what he was in the corner. So I said, I would work out all there. What are you going with that fool? And again, send word to King Lear. One tries your mother like her. She's a hundred of him. From there, also.
So I'm wondering what we will see on stage. I've seen you before, and you've had a lot of recorded elements. Are you actually doing some speaking roles as part of this production?
This is all talk.
All talk.
All news, all talk, all the time.
K-L-W.
Yeah.
God help us if we were to go that way.
Yeah. I call it a play, but... In rehearsal, I would talk about our script, and I would talk about text. So we use chunks of Shakespeare, which we call text, and then script is the envelope. So, yeah, and I play all these characters, and I try and delineate them very carefully, and I think people so far have been quite impressed by the fact that they can figure out who's talking when. Because, you know, I do the voices and try and give each character a specific physical presence as well.
Right. Well, I was rereading some of the fool's lines last night.
Don't. Oh, no. You'll kill yourself. Yes.
And as I mentioned, he's anything but a fool, really reversing roles with his benefactor, quite critical and spot on of the king's foibles and decisions and bad decisions. Now, unemployed, as others in the king's circles would not tolerate a fool as lightly as...
Well, he's unemployed because the king's dead, basically.
And others around him have witnessed his foul tongue or his rather frank tongue. I wouldn't hire him.
Well, yeah, but he was able to speak truth to power, and he was the best of his kind at it. So he was very well respected because he had the protection of the king. So, yes, there are people who are probably happy that he's fallen, but he needs to work. So here he is, post-mortem Rex, you know, he's looking for work.
Are there other Shakespearean fools that are perhaps ripe for potential one-man shows down the road?
You know, I've sometimes thought of the Scottish play. We're not in a theatre now, are we? Now I can say the word. But let's not push our luck. I open on Saturday. The Scottish play from the point of view of the porter. Just see what that would do. Or Twelfth Night from Malvolio's point of view. There is an English...
Richard III from the horse's point of view.
All right. There is an English actor called Tim Crouch who has done a solo piece called I, Malvolio, which is kind of interesting. And it's a sort of an emotional deconstruction of Malvolio's condition throughout the play. And he talks about the other characters and how he was abused and, you know, misinterpreted, and just shifts the focus. I mean, that's what we're doing. I mean, you know, people say, oh, yeah, Tom Stoppard did Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, and that's, you know, their perspective. The play happens off stage. We hear Hamlet's lines. We hear Claudius's lines. But There is a certain element of that, but except that we're putting it all on stage, and it's my story. I was there. Don't think that you know what happened with King Lear, because you don't, because I was there.
And so when you go back and forth with the other characters, though, does the fool chime in? Is it a back and forth thing, or is a character that appears for a while?
No, he comments. So and specifically, we've tried to use the text, the Shakespeare, as a basis for some fairly off the cuff comments that the fool makes about power, about the king, about the other characters, and also about his own condition. That, you know, he starts to realize as he's recounting what he's actually been through the last 47 years as he's been the king, because we make him a king, contemporary of the king. He's as old as the king. And, you know, as the king says, even though we don't use the line, I'm very foolish, fond old man, 80 and up. So he's over 80. Well, I'm not playing him over 80. But I've had some practice. You know, I did Geezer. It seems a logical progression to do a piece about
nose hair and
about losing your shtick, you know, as you get older.
It's Jeff Hoyle. He's in the one-man show Lear's Shadow at the Marsh through the 30th and performing on his birthday next Wednesday, the 15th. Why don't you bring him a card and catch the show at the Marsh?
That's right. Bring me a cake.
The Marsh.
49 candles on it. How old are you?
Lear's Shadow runs through the 30th of May, themarsh.org. Jeff Hoyle, thanks for coming in today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
What kind of fool am I, who never fell in love? It seems that I'm the only one that I have been thinking of. What kind of man is this? An empty shell, a lonely cell in which an empty heart must dwell. What kind of lips are these that lied with every kiss, that whispered empty words of love, that left me alone like this? Why can't I fall in love like any other man? And maybe then I'll know what kind.
That's Jeff Hoyle as the fool, a very different type of fool, Shakespeare's King Lear's fool, at the Marsh through the 30th. Again, more information at themarsh.org. Saturday, I mentioned the San Francisco Wind Ensemble is performing out at Aragon High School. Well, it's a busy, busy evening as the UC Alumni Chorus with the Smuin Ballet is performing Carmina Burana, also Saturday evening, also at 7:30 at the Berkeley Community Theater, with quite a hearty, robust bunch of people. Over 200 singers, alumni of the music programs at the University of California in collaboration with Smuin Ballet. Dancers from one of the Bay Area's most foremost ballet companies, choreography by Michael Smuin. Here to talk about the concert is Mark Sumner, who is the director of chorus activities at the University of California. He's been director of music also at the First Unitarian Universalist Church here in San Francisco, both these positions for the last 15 years. Now, in addition to herding these cats, he's also conducts the UC Women's Chorale, preparing the singers in Perfect Fifth and Bare Stage Musical each year, and mentors student musical directors in five other ensembles. He also manages to find time to sing with Volti, American Bach soloists, Chalice Consort, and various other Bay Area groups. Mark Sumner, welcome to Open Air. My gosh, what a busy, busy man.
Yeah, I'm tired just listening to you.
I'm just going to turn off the mic and put on some music. So 15 years at UC. Congratulations.
Thanks. Actually, it's 18 and a half.
18 and a half.
Finishing my 19th, actually.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Excellent. So you must have been able to build quite a not necessarily a legacy, but just build the program.
Well, it's been going on since, Bob Commande in the 50s and early 60s.
I had no idea. I know Bob.
Yes.
I didn't know he did that.
Yes, he started all of that and, didn't start it, but continued it. We've been around for well over 100 years now. And the Alumni Chorus is celebrating, I guess, their 35th anniversary this year.
Well, that's quite an accomplishment in itself. These are graduates from all aspects of the choral programs at UC, right?
Many of the other programs, they sang with the glee clubs and whatnot, but
somehow involved in music.
Not that many were actual music majors. Mm-hmm. And we continue that I head the extracurricular department there at Cal. So it's we have 9 different ensembles and very few are actual majors.
Well, let's talk about this particular production of Carmina Burana and just a little bit about Carl Orff. This is a work that really made his entire fortune, I would say.
Yes, yes.
An amazing piece of music. If those that aren't familiar, of course, the very opening. That's not the opening. The opening of that one would recognize immediately had I played it properly. Music that has been everything from commercially used to introducing Dick Cheney at times. Quite a piece of music. And tell us a little bit about the texts that Orff used to compile this music.
Well, those are pretty legendary, and we've had a lot of fun sharing these texts with our students. We're involving the men's and women's chorale as well. And so this is an introductory experience for them. We've done the piece before with the alumni chorus some 15 years ago with dancers from the university, the theater and dance department there. And it's interesting. We're trying to give a visual impact with the Smyon Ballet and not detract from them. I've asked my singers to look just at the lyrics and present the music holding just lyrics in their hands. And the music is, you know, easy to wrap your head around and recall. So I think there's a stronger connection to the texts
than
other performances.
And the texts are in 3 languages as well, aren't they?
Yes, yes. And we've been having fun. Actually, on the same program, we're doing a slightly different version of a German pronunciation when we do some a cappella choruses from the Catulli Carmina, which he wrote several years after Carmina Burana.
Tell us about the soloists that are being engaged for this performance.
Oh, they're very experienced Carmina soloists. If you've been to other Carminas, you've probably run into Eugene Brancoviano and Brian Stoffenbiel doing the iconic Dying Roasting Swan solo, and then Shanette Sulker is our lovely soprano.
Well, let's see. Tell us about that Roasting Swan solo, and I'm going to try to cue it up here if I can find it. What is the Roasting Swan solo?
Well, it's his feature moment, and it's in a range that very few can handle. But since we're doing a slightly different orchestration, I've developed, instead of a bassoon, I've started the piece off with a flute and muted trumpet, recreating that sound, and it with the tam tam and with the xylophone and all these strange combinations of instruments. Brian does an amazing job by himself creating a great visual, and with the Smyon Ballet soloist involved at the same time, it's a very interesting. Last night we did a dress rehearsal, and we decided that the two of them together in tandem would reference each other, which we don't quite break that wall in other movements of the piece.
Well, let's hear a bit of that music of the Roasting Swan, the words of which share with us the swan who says that he was once this beautiful animal and now he's roasted on the spit.
Yes, exactly. It's quite remarkable.
poor swan, now black and roasting fiercely, telling that the serving boy is about to serve him on a platter. Miserable that he is now. Speaking with Mark Sumner about the massive performance of Carmina Burana this Saturday at the Berkeley Community Theater on Alston Way in Berkeley. 7:30 for that performance, the UC Alumni Chorus and Smuin Ballet production. You'll hear Brian Stauffenbiel sing that aria. We just heard John Van Kester in a performance from the label EMI, Angel AMI, with Riccardo Muti conducting that. Now, you mentioned that we're going to see some interesting visuals there with Brian and the Smuin Ballet. How else is the choreography coming into play in this production?
Well, Smuin did performances of this just last year with recording, and the recording was the Tilson Thomas Cleveland Orchestra recording.
Mm,
so we're, because in their bones they are accustomed to tempi and pacings, and so all of the movements that they're dancing, we've had to try to recreate that for them because they've got their moves down. So it's been a challenge for us to replicate that. And Tilson Thomas loves the faster movements faster and the slower movements slower, and we've been trying for those contrasts, and I think succeeding quite well. The dancers seem to be very happy with what we're doing. So
you mentioned that it's a reduced orchestration, so what are we going to hear as the orchestra?
Well, usually you get the two piano six percussionist version. We're actually using Alan Biggs and his students from San Francisco State. We're collaborating with all sorts of different people. We've got those folks, there's 13 of them playing all the different instruments, and then we have a flute, which is very important in the piece, and a couple of trumpets, which adds the brilliance that you would expect in certain moments in the piece. And another piece that we're doing on the program is by Ola Yelo, which is a up-and-coming, very, very popular composer that a lot of choruses are becoming familiar with now, and it involves a string quartet. So I just couldn't let them go home after performing that, so we're going to ask them to take part in this as well. So we've got kind of an interesting, unique mix of sounds coming from what isn't the pit. We're actually behind the dancers, so kind of all crammed at the back, trying to pretend to look like a psych curtain.
Well,
some 230 of us.
And just getting that amount of people together to do this must be quite a challenge.
Yeah, and I actually enjoy that. The collaborative aspects of all of this is what I enjoy the most.
Seanette Selker will be soprano, soloist Brian Stauffenbiel on tenor, singing tenor, UC Alumni Chorus, Santa Barbara Choral Society, UC Women's and Men's Chorale, and choreography by Michael Smuin with members of the Smuin Ballet. It should be quite an evening of music.
Yes, yes.
Another soloist I should mention, Eugene Brancovenu, who will be the baritone soloist. We're going to play a movement now that's become quite rollicking, shall we say. It's from the tavern section of the piece. Set that up for us, would you?
Well, the Men's Chorale really loves this one. It closes the second part of the Carmina Burana, and it's all, actually the whole section is called In the Tavern. The women aren't singing, I guess not allowed, and it's just pretty much four short movements ending with this rollicking, like you say, tavern song, and it goes out with a bang.
Introduced by the baritone as the Abbot of Kukani? Cooking?
Oh, yes, depending on how you... Yeah.
And he's talking about his drinking habits and how his desires to be in the school of Decius, and whoever seeks him in the early in the tavern, by evening he will go out bare, stripped of his clothes, he will cry, Wafna. We'll hear now the baritone soloist, who's on baritone on this, John Van Kesteren. Well, we heard Jonathan Summers sing the earlier tenor thing. This is John Van Kesteren with Riccardo Muti conducting the In Taberna section of Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, which you can hear this Saturday at 7:30 at the Berkeley Community Theater. Mark, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Performance.
Oh, thanks.
Music
thanks.
Of Karl Orff.
Ego, 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 summabas, cucaniensis. Et consilium meum est cum bibulis. Et insecta deci voluntas meast, et
mane meque sierit in taverna, post vesperam nudus egredietur. Et sic denudatus veste clama. Abstulisti omnia.
Carmina Burana in Taberna, the drinking students, monks, and priests from Carmina Burana. You can hear that performance of the UC Alumni Chorus and Smuin Ballet Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Berkeley Community Theater. Information at ucac.net. David LaTulipe here now with Peter Robinson, returning with some cultural news on museum fronts and movie screens.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And, yeah, my choice movie for the week, Woman in Gold, is just a very bracing historical drama starring Helen Mirren. And this time she's speaking with, I can only describe it as a strudel-thick Austrian accent. And she does a good job. And she is very much centre stage throughout this whole picture. She plays the role of Maria Altman. It's based on a true story, and Maria Altman was a Holocaust survivor. She came from a wealthy Austrian Jewish family, and among the collections of art they had in their house was a famous painting by Gustav Klimt, which of course gives the film its title, Woman in Gold. So I think this is a movie which looks at the past, looks at the present, and in a kaleidoscopic way brings both these elements of history together. In 1939, after the Nazis finally invaded and then took over Austria, and you see these very dramatic flashes in the movie, they invade Maria Hauptmann's house, they seize the paintings. Some of the family are immediately captured and will later die, but Maria herself escapes with her fiancé to the United States. And that is the role which is played, as I said, by Helen Mirren. And as the story develops, this turns very much into a courtroom drama, a courtroom thriller, in fact, since in the 90s, the various pieces of art which were seized by the Nazis begin to surface and are returned to certain governments. And in the case of Austria, they want to assume that Woman in Gold is part of their national heritage and not the individual heritage of the people who owned the painting originally. It had a price value for what it's worth of $100 million, but Maria is not interested in the money value of the painting. She is interested in making the connection between personal ownership and whether the what is now the new Austrian government had the rights to retain that painting, which was in fact her family's painting. In fact, the woman in the painting was her aunt. So you've got an intriguing backstory going on here. It's about art, it's about history, it's also about international law and how her lawyer, whom she chooses because the family happened to be a friend of the original family. He's also the grandson of Schoenberg, the composer. He takes on the case, and the case moves back and forth between New York and Austria. And as the drama sort of crescendos, I think everyone gets, certainly in the audience around me, psychologically engaged as to what will happen to this paintings. And I found the flashbacks were particularly helpful because it keeps you in mind how the art was stolen originally. The film is directed by Simon Curtis. You may remember him from My Week with Marilyn. And he brings really a deft touch. Compare it to George Clooney's The Monuments Men, and you've got a far better film here, a film which really looks at the value of art in our lives and, at the same time, what is rightfully one person's or rightfully the state's. And, as I say, at the centre of this is not only a meditation about art, but also about the character that Helen Mirren plays, Maria, who, when she made her successful escape to this country, finally opens a boutique in Los Angeles. And so by the end of the film, which does have a rousing end, you have seen what took 10 years in legal life contracted down to less than 2 hours in movie time. Maria shimmers, the audience rises. It's a great story. It's a thriller. And I think it's also a movie about soulfulness, about how painting can change your lives and the role that it contributes to a culture. Highly recommended. It's called Woman in Gold. Just a brief word now about two particular movie houses in the Bay Area. One is the Kabuki and the other is the Lark in Marin County. And on certain days, they have something known as NT Live. NT Live stands for the National Theatre in London. And this is a new way of transmitting extremely unusual, beautiful plays. The next running at the Kabuki is called Behind the Beautiful Forevers. It's based on a David Herr play. And then we have a new Tom Stoppard play called The Hard Problem. And you really feel you are there in the Olivier Theatre in London, the way they screen these. The camera work is superb, and there's also an intermission with a brief interview with the author or the playwright. So if you're looking for something different to see at the theatre, highly recommend the Kabuki or the Lark, and you have to check on the times because these don't run for several consecutive days. Three of the upcoming productions, Behind the Beautiful Forever, The Hard Problem, and then the Arthur Miller famous play A View from the Bridge. Later in the season, Benedict Cumberbatch, who we may remember from The Imitation Game, will be appearing as Hamlet. So those are three treats in mind for people who enjoy both movies and the theatre. And finally, this time of year, if you haven't taken a trip up to the Palace of the Legion of Honour, there are some beautiful views of the Vay just before you actually go into the Art Museum. It's high on the hill. It overlooks the Golden Gate Bridge. And in the late afternoon, around about 2:30 after lunch, there are a series of lectures. Last week I went to one called The Hidden Messages Behind Painting, truly worth seeing. And the main exhibition at the moment for fashionistas is called High Style. It's from the Brooklyn Museum of Costume, costume collection, which looks at essentially the way feminine fashions have changed between 1910 and 1980. So you get a whole piece of cultural history going on, the fashions throughout, in fact, two different major wars, if you think about it, the First World War and the Second World War, and then the way the designers crisscrossed the Atlantic and gave us these very different fashionable styles. So plenty to do now that spring is here, whether you're going to the theatre, whether you're going to the movies, or whether you want to take real live art in your eyes at the Palace of the Legion of Honour.
Thanks so much, Peter. We look forward to your next update for things cultural all around the Bay Area.
Good to be here, David. Thank you.
Well, in addition to things, lots of concerts going on, as I mentioned, the San Francisco Wind Ensemble, and also the UC Alumni Chorus. Capella SF has a concert. After also on the San Francisco Symphony, Joshua Bell is soloist for the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, Pablo Jerez Casado conducting the symphony and works chamber symphonies also by Schoenberg and John Adams, sfsymphony.org for that. And then on the 12th and 14th, Sunday the 12th, a matinee, and this coming Tuesday at 7:30, the Marin Symphony performs under the direction of Alistair Neal, celebrating the Marin Symphony Youth Orchestra, which turns 60 years young this year. They'll be sitting in with the regular orchestra for Sibelius's Finlandia, also on the program Strauss's Don Juan, Poulenc Gloria, and by Mason Bates, Mothership is a featured work. Information at marinsymphony.org for that performance. Going out with music, just a touch of music of Paul Simon, because it's Steve Gadd's birthday. Great drummer that you hear starting things off. He turned 70 today, featured on Paul Simon's 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. Our programs are archived at kalw.org. Search for Open Air. My thanks to Neil Swinkels for greasing the wheels of Open Air once again. Join me next week, same time, same place, 1 o'clock on Thursdays. Open Air.
She said it's really not my habit to intrude. Furthermore, I hope my meaning won't be lost or misconstrued. But I'll repeat myself at the risk of being crude. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. 50 ways to leave your lover. You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Or hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. Ooh, slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. You just listen to me. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. She said it grieves me so to see you in such pain. I wish.
Happy birthday, drummer Steve Gadd. An hour of news from the BBC is coming up next here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. It's 2 o'clock.